Hi, I'm Steve Goldstein, and this is the Friday Newscap podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode.
Yeah, over and over again, you know, we want to have trust. It's built on the premise that we're truthful, that we come forward. But there's no truth with you whatsoever. That's why that's important to you, to look up here and look at the old adage that our moms taught us, liar, liar, pants on fire. No one should ever listen to you and give you credibility.
It appears to me that Cohen is not lying to the committee. I think he's being forthright. And I think the things that he's making have to be looked at and taken very seriously.
Obviously, we have to fund the operations of State Farm Stadium and keep the lights on out here. And the rental car tax was a good portion of that revenue that came in that we used.
I think people, the ratepayers in the APS territory, are paying an awful lot in fees. And I think they have a right to know where the monopoly that they have to get their, who their provider services spending, where they're spending their money.
And with us to talk about Michael Cohen and Congressman Paul Gosar and Governor Ducey's perspectives on vaccination, rather not vacation, and more are Chad Campbell of Strategies 360 and Emily Ryan of Copper State Consulting. Chad, unless you did want to comment on the governor's views on vacation.
No, we're not going to go. Okay, thanks.
Okay, let's start off with Michael Cohen and especially Paul Gosar with the Arizona connection there. First of all, what did you make of the theater of Cohen to begin with?
It was something straight out of like a movie, basically. I was kind of mind-blowing to watch. You had a hard time sometimes grasping that this was reality, quite honestly. I feel like I was watching like an old episode of House of Cards or something. What I found interesting for the most part from the GOP was the fact that they were kind of attacking Cohen as opposed to really asking any substantive questions about his relationship with Trump, other than I think there were maybe one or two questions from the GOP. It was really trying to undermine Cohen, and I get it, you know, that's politics. But I found it ironic that, again, when Cohen was there previously and he lied and obviously he's going to prison for lying, they were applauding him then because he was defending President Trump. But now they're trying to turn the corner and make it sound like he's a liar against Trump. So the whole thing was kind of theater of the absurd to me.
Emily, politics as usual then, based on what Chad is saying, that, hey, if someone's on our side, it's okay. If they're not, not so much?
Well, yeah, politics as usual to a degree. But I think once someone is actually going to prison for lying, it's a fair attack to go at his credibility. If you've watched any movie, any mob movie, the rat always gets disparaged in the trial, you know.
Emily Ryan's saying the rat. I'm just enjoying that for a second.
But you've got Cohen sitting there, you know. He's shown himself to be a liar. He's going to do time for it. And now we're supposed to hang on his every word. I think it was fair to attack his credibility. Cohen did miss a great opportunity, though, to respond to Gosar by saying, it takes one to know one.
Well, or I was thinking maybe sticks and stone, something. You know, I was waiting for some brilliant comeback. Yeah. I would say, though, the one thing that to Emily's point that really hit me was, it was actually, I felt like I was watching the beginning of the end of a mob criminal syndicate, to be honest with you. And the one thing that kind of hit me too is, you know, for the Republicans questioning his viability or his credibility, whatever you want to call it, and questioning his honesty, you have to ask yourself then, why would the president hire somebody like that in the first place? And there's a character trait, I think, amongst many of the president's advisors that we're seeing. There's a trend here. And quite frankly, it is like a criminal syndicate. It's like you're watching a mob boss in action. And I think this is the beginning. I mean, this is how it starts, to the point. This is how, you know, Al Capone went down. This is how mobsters go down. They have an informant that turns on them, and the house of cards starts to crumble. And I think we're seeing the beginning of that, quite honestly.
Emily, is there any real value to a hearing like this? I mean, Chad referred to it as watching like House of Cards. I mean, it did have sort of a reality TV kind of feel to it. Other than letting members of a particular committee have their say and get their time on national TV, is there any utility to holding hearings like this anymore?
There's political value. You know, the Democratic Party really wanted to put Cohen up there and, come on, air the dirty laundry. We hated you last time you were here. Now we want to hear it. Give us the goods. Let's all act astonished. And we've got all these great sound bites to run on. So, yeah, it's political theater, and it serves a political purpose. It doesn't serve a productive purpose.
I mean, do we learn anything from these anymore? Absent the political stuff, do we, like, does the public actually learn anything that we can use to make informed decisions about how we feel about things?
I don't know. I mean, I think that's tough. I think the one thing you did see in this was you did see some documents that we hadn't seen before. Mm-hmm. Checks from Trump, the letter regarding his education background. Some of that stuff was new. And I honestly think you started to see a little bit behind the door on the probe, on the Mueller probe. And that was interesting to me. I think we're seeing at least an indication of where that probe has been headed. But I think for the most part it was, you know, a lot of politicking on both sides and both sides kind of laying down the marker, so to speak.
Emily, what is up? I don't mean this in a disrespectful way, with Paul Gosar. Is this a change? Has he been like this? And I only say this is not even from conservative political standpoint, because that's fine, that's his ideology. But he does seem to do some things that strike people as sort of odd. Was his behavior, even the liar, liar, pants on fire, cardboard sign, what we've come to expect from Paul Gosar, was it unbefitting a congressman, as Michael Cohen tried to suggest?
You know, I actually am of the opinion that it's pretty rich of Michael Cohen to be sitting there in a congressional setting, in a hearing, after having lied to congressmen, and to pick that moment to get smart and cute with a sitting congressman. I can't even imagine. Your heart would be beating so hard you'd hear it in your eardrums, and that's when he picks to fire back and get cute with him. I think Congressman Gosar was playing into the setup of political theater and taking it his own direction and really going overboard to make his point.
Chad?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was an odd tactic from Gosar, to say the least. And I think Gosar and Meadows, I think, came out looking pretty bad, honestly. I don't think they came out as winners in this whole thing. I don't think Cohen could have ever come out as a winner in this thing. He came in as a pretty unsympathetic character and will remain that. But I think Gosar probably left that hearing looking the worst out of anybody in that hearing, including possibly even Cohen, to be honest with you.
One more quickie about Gosar. Chad, let me start with you on this. So when he was first elected to Congress, that was an odd district. I said the oddly shaped large district. He sort of had to appeal to a broader base. So was he playing politics at that point, or has he dramatically changed in the last number of years?
I mean, I don't know, Ryan. Congressman Gosar. I've never even met him. But yeah, looking at where he was when he first got elected to where he is today, he's either his true self has come out, or he's changed to match his base. You know, either way, I don't really think that's the appropriate way for a congressman to behave. But
Emily, quick reply on that. What do you think? Where's the real Paul Gosar?
I think we're seeing the real Paul Gosar. I think when a congressman has some seniority and some tenure and has been there a while, they start to get comfortable and start to see the real them come out. And I think he's being his authentic self. You know, people change. He's certainly leaning into it hard if it's an act. So
he's also in a district where he doesn't really have to worry about, like, his base is, like, that district is very conservative. He doesn't have to worry about, as to Steve's point earlier about in the first district, which was a little more competitive, his district now is not competitive. He doesn't have to worry. He has to worry about being primary from the right as opposed to somebody on the left.
Absolutely. And tactically, he's doing the right thing by just letting it go and leaning right into that. And, you know, he's pretty untouchable right now.
All right, so let's talk about something else that came out at the Capitol this week, at the state Capitol this week, as opposed to the U.S. Capitol. Vaccinations are, again, a big topic of discussion here in Arizona. Emily, were you surprised that Governor Ducey came out and basically said, I will veto any bill that might lead to fewer kids being vaccinated in this state?
I wasn't surprised. I was proud of him for taking that stand. You know, however you feel about the vaccination issue, you know, a real governor leads by signaling to the legislature what I'm going to go along with, what I'm not. I've got to look out for the health of the Arizona people. I'm not going to play this game. You know, I think the people that are concerned about vaccinations come from a very sincere place, and they've got some valid concerns. But I think the governor is comforting Arizonans with whatever the legislature sends up, I'm not going to go this far with it. We're going to have children in schools vaccinated. We're going to keep our state safe.
And, Chad, the governor, as governors in the past have done, typically don't comment on bills before they get to them. That's sort of their longstanding policy. Is it a symbol of how significant this issue is that the governor was kind of willing to violate that policy on this one?
Yeah, and I will say I think we're also seeing kind of a new Governor Ducey since the election. The veto of the tax conformity bill was not a soft veto by any means. He made that loud and clear that he did not want that coming to his desk. And when it did, he vetoed it immediately and then made a very public showing of that veto. So I don't think Governor Ducey is kind of sitting back and going to let the legislature go against what his agenda is. And I think for the anti-vaccination stuff, you know, from the education standpoint, it's a huge issue. And we're seeing it in other states. We're seeing these outbreaks of things that we should not be experiencing in this day and age. I mean, this is a very anti-scientific movement. And from the business community, when you're trying to attract new jobs, new employers in Arizona, the last thing you want to be dealing with when you're trying to attract new employers is employers who have employees that are fearful of moving to a state because there's an anti-vaccination movement taking root. So I think the governor is doing what fits in with his principles of you know, pro-economic development, trying to fix the schools. Made sense to me. And again, I think he's laying the marker down with the legislature.
If this is, in fact, a new Governor Ducey, how else might we see that manifest itself in the months ahead of this session?
I mean, the budget is going to be a big one. You saw it with the DCP. He did a good job on the DCP. Education funding. It will be interesting to see how all this stuff plays out. But the budget is going to be the big battle. And you're going to have a contingent of the far right that probably is not going to align with Governor Ducey's budget as he announced it on the State of the State, or, you know, right off the State of the State. And so can he build a coalition of Democrats and Republicans to get a budget passed? Or is he going to have to kind of try to placate that far right? It'll be interesting to see. And I think that, you know, I don't think Governor Ducey wants to compromise much in his budget. I think he's pretty set in stone on what the basic fundamentals of his budget are, at least.
Emily?
And we're going to see what the legislature does in response to this, both on vaccinations, on the budget, you know, with conformity. They knew he was not in line with their plan. They sent it up anyway. You know, people that feel strongly on the vaccination issue, the legislature may want to send a message again. Just because he said he's going to veto it doesn't mean they won't spend the next few passionate months sending that up. It could mean we're there a very long time in session this year.
Are these things cumulative? In other words, like, so the legislature sent up a tax conformity bill that the governor had said he would veto. He vetoed it quickly. The governor said he doesn't want these vaccination bills. He's talked about some of the stuff with the budget. Like, do these things add up to eventually lead to sort of a protracted battle between the legislature and the governor, or are each of these sort of viewed on their own merits?
Oh, it all is lumped together. It's all one big emotional experience. And you know, I think that the more times they hit a block wall with that, the more the legislative branch is going to want to exert their authority as a sole and separate branch and send their own message and put the governor on record. I think that it's just going to lead to very difficult talks. The emotion bleeds into a number of issues and just makes it hard.
And one thing I will say, you know, over the years prior to when I was in the legislature and since I love the legislature, the governor usually wins these battles. I'm just going to point that out. You know, I was there during Medicaid expansion. I worked with Governor Brewer. You know, we had a Republican majority who was adamantly against us, and we ended up winning at the end of the day. Napolitano did the same thing time and time again. The governor usually wins these battles. That's what I would kind of predict.
But in order to do so, he may have to partner up with the strong Democratic numbers
exactly
we
right.
see at the legislature. And sometimes that's a political win for Republicans looking to put him on record is doing that.
Yeah, I think you'll have a coalition of Dems and Republicans on several issues this
session. I can see that
session.
Happening.
Yep. Yeah. That's Chad Campbell. Also here is Emily Ryan. I'm Steve Goldstein with Mark Brody. And the newscap continues after this. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap here on KJZZ with Mark Brody in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Also with us are Emily Ryan of Copper State Consulting and Chad Campbell of Strategies 360. So, Chad, apparently, we don't know for sure, apparently some emails were lost Michelle Reagan, when she was Secretary of State, maybe she was deleting them because she didn't want Steve Gaynor to read them or something, but as it turns out, Katie Hobbs is in the office. What do we make of this now? The Attorney General, Mark Brnovich's office, is looking into whether emails were deleted, where they might be.
Well, it's problematic. You know, there's a lot of rules in place that prevent elected officials and agencies from deleting emails for good reason. These are matters of public record, I don't know the details, obviously, but I think it's a serious enough issue that I do believe the AG investigation is merited. And you know, this came about because there was a FOIA request from media. And I think Secretary Hobbs did the right thing when they tried to find those emails, realized they couldn't find them. And from what I know, reading what I've read and talking to different people across the board, they took a deep dive with IT and couldn't find them. You know, they went to the AG's office and submitted this report or this letter. And that made sense because I don't think that she wants to be held responsible or blamed for these missing emails. And so now I think it's up to the AG and the powers that be to take a deep dive and find out what's truly going on.
Emily, does it seem strange that Michelle Reagan's office would have done this? Could there be an easy explanation for this?
I mean, there certainly could be. I'm no IT expert, but, you know, I suppose that's in the realm of possibilities. It would be very strange that the office charged with keeping Arizona State's records intact would be deleting records. I would find that surprising and concerning. So, you know, I'm hopeful that there will be a logical explanation for that.
How do these investigations tend to go? I mean, obviously, you know, the elected officials are not necessarily the IT experts either. How do they try to go about getting to the bottom of what actually happened?
Well, I mean, the Attorney General's office is going to have to launch into that and talk to a lot of people and get forensic experts to go in and kind of reconstruct at what point, where in the system were those emails deleted, what are they missing. You know, we went through this with then Commissioner Stump's cell phone at one point, right, and we never really – so it was sort of a lackluster result. We never really got these salacious text messages that everyone was waiting for. And so, you know, I don't think you're going to see some huge smoking gun. I think it's going to be a pretty bland investigation, but, you know, they'll dig in and get the answers.
Well, and I think, you know, that is the question is, if these emails were deleted on purpose, why? That's a huge question. If that's the case, that's a pretty serious problem. And if they weren't deleted, you know, purposely, or they got lost in the system, then again, I think it's an indication of probably why Michelle Reagan is no longer our Secretary of State, to be honest with you. There were a lot of performance issues in that office, as we know, both with the elections and communications, everything else. But you know, if the AG finds that these emails were deleted on purpose, then that's a big question mark. And then I think the AG has to take a deeper dive into finding out what was going on and why they were deleted, to your point, Mark, and where you go once you go down that rabbit hole, who knows?
When you talked about issues with performance under the former Secretary of State, one of those issues tended to be IT-type stuff, website-type stuff.
Yeah. No, I mean, so to Emily's point, I don't know if it was intentional or not. If it was intentional, there could be some serious problems there. And if it was unintentional, it's probably, though, just another indicator of why Michelle Reagan didn't even make it out of the Republican primary, to be honest with you.
Yeah, and as long with not being an IT expert, I'm also not a legal expert.
Yeah. Why are you on again?
That won't stop me from saying that I think intent would be pretty difficult to prove as well. That's a pretty tall order.
That's a huge, huge range you guys are talking about. There could be an innocent, though incompetent, mistake, or it could be a huge scandal. I mean, it's a huge range.
No, exactly. And I think, you know, the AG, to his credit, has been pretty good about investigating people over the years in a nonpartisan manner across both sides of the aisle. So I have faith that he'll do so in this case. But there's a huge range. It could be innocent, not really good at IT stuff, as Emily isn't, obviously, over here, right? Or it could be, you know, Watergate cover-up at the Arizona level. I'm facetious, obviously, but there could be something there, and we'll see what happens.
So the last thing, Mark, and I want to cover this morning has to do with the minimum wage, which Arizona voters apparently made a decision on that, Emily, but there are some lawmakers who've decided, you know, some people need to get a lot less than what we've determined as a new minimum wage. What do you make of this generally, this legislation brought forth by Travis Grantham?
You know, it's interesting. I watched a discussion on that for hours this week in the House gallery. And, you know, what's interesting is Republicans are coming at this trying to solve a problem where they believe, and they have been sought out by business owners who are having a hard time hiring college students, that student working class. And they also are hearing from that class saying, we can't get jobs anymore. And so they are trying to, you know, you can debate, you can make an argument either way whether this furthers the intent of the voters. Their intention is to create another class of employee that can negotiate different salary terms so that they can actually work when it's a case of job or no job. And to go back to that part-time student working situation, you know, there's also debate on this, on whether it needs a three-fourths majority vote. It passed out of the House yesterday with a simple majority. The Republicans don't have a three-fourths majority vote, and it was all along party lines. But, you know, they're really not trying to get away with not paying. They're actually trying to create an opportunity, like many of us went to school, to go to school and be able to work part-time and not be boxed out of that.
Emily, do you think this leads to a lawsuit, assuming that it passes and the governor signs it?
Oh, I think so. I think absolutely. I think, you know, there will be groups that will bring in it. It's a complicated bill on a complicated topic, and we've got a voter protected, you know, act situation. So, yeah, I do think it will lead to litigation.
Chad, you're nodding your head as well.
Yeah. First of all, I don't think this necessarily solves a real problem. I understand what Emily's saying, but I think if you look at the numbers, the amount of people that are affected negatively by this situation is few and far between in the grand scheme of things. And so I think this is probably a very limited scope solution, quote unquote. But I don't see how this furthers the act of or the furthers the will of the voters. I don't see it as a holding up in court. The voters did not pass a measure that says some people get paid this much money and other people over here get paid this much money. Yeah. They passed a measure that says everybody gets paid at least this much money, and I think it'll have a hard time standing up in court, and I think there will be a lawsuit. I almost guarantee that.
And I think that the court issue will come down to whether or not it needed a three-fourths vote. I think you can say putting people to work furthers the intent. And keep in mind, it's a very Republican principle, the right to contract, the right to set your own terms, the right to, hey, I want that experience, I'll do it for less. And that's how I got my start.
Agreed. But again, minimum wage has been – it's a tried and true statutory measure. I mean, it's been there forever. It's a federal law. It's a state law. I don't think you can actually create another class of people that somehow gets out of minimum wage. It's passed by the voters. I just don't think you can do it. I don't think it'll stand up if it does pass. I'm not convinced it's going to pass the Senate, to be honest with you. I don't know if it's going to pass yet, honestly.
Well, and Emily, it seemed like some of the debate was over whether or not this actually affects the voter-approved minimum wage law. Representative Grantham kept saying this would be a new section of statute, which
right.
that law never talked about. So they're part of his argument for why this didn't need that extra majority vote to further the intent of a voter-approved law.
Right, and that gets into we're creating a separate class of employment where these students can get to work and get the experience they want to further themselves.
And again, I have a feeling a court will disagree with that very strongly.
That is Chad Campbell of Strategies 360. Also with us, Emily Ryan of Copper State Consulting. Guys, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Friday Newscap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's big stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at theshow@kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein, and thanks for listening.